good morning. Welcome to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, and we're always following the money, and we make no exception today. My first guest is John Grobe. He is president of Federal Career Experts, and he wrote the book called Career Transition, A Guide for Federal Employees. And John is with us. John, are you in Minneapolis now?
No, I am in Chicago.
Chicago, okay. Well, how's the weather, first off?
Well, we have some snow, but I think this year you people out east have been getting worse weather than we have. It's still, despite a snowy February, overall a dry winter.
Okay, well, fortunately, most of that heavy snow has been far to the north, but it's been good for skiers around here. John, we know what's happening. Sequestration may or may not hit March 1. That would be Friday. If it does, many agencies are planning to furlough people, some for up to 22 days. That would be one day a week for the next 6 or 7 months. Others are talking about a 1 or a 2 day furlough, but at any rate, it's a kind of a hairy time to be a federal worker. And following that, and what many people think is an even greater threat, is the continuing resolution flap. Congress keeps kicking it down the road, and this is a stopgap spending bill. If that's not approved, then sequestration could look minor by comparison with the government shutdowns, and then you have the debt ceiling fight yet to come. But it's an uncertain time to be a federal worker. The number of people retiring has stepped up in the last year or so, and of course a lot of that is age-related. Some of it may be tied to the 2 year going on 3 federal pay freeze, and some of it is maybe people are just tired of working for the government. What do you think?
I think all of those are true. I also think it's funny that we would look back longingly on the 1980s when we only had this deadline once a year, generally sometime around October 1st when they were fighting over the budget. It seems that you're right, the can keeps getting kicked down the road, but it's getting kicked shorter and shorter distances. It seems we went through something like this with the debt ceiling limit just a little while ago. It certainly does nothing for federal employees' productivity. It's unsettling and probably is one of the biggest topics of water cooler conversation out there.
Well, when he retires, Senator Dan Inouye of Hawaii, a Democrat, a statesman, if you will, and a war hero, he's kind of got sick of the Senate and sick of Congress, and he said they had only approved, I think, 3 appropriations bills in the last 19 or 20 years, approved them on time. So that's not a very good track record, and it's like having a dysfunctional board of directors if you're in the private sector. Now, if I'm a government worker, and I'm thinking about leaving, what should I be doing?
Well, I think we are in the frying pan now. I think we want to find out how hot the fire that we are going to jump into is. If we're thinking about retirement as our way of leaving, we ought to look at what we are likely to receive for retirement, have a retirement estimate made, figure out what we can receive from our TSP, and I think even more importantly, what are we going to do with our time? I think it's better for individuals who retire to retire to something as opposed to retire from something. And it appears that with a lot of the threats, people are retiring from something. I had a conversation with an employee from one of the Treasury bureaus a few days ago, and all of this, all these threats about sequestration and so on got him to sit down and crunch his numbers, and he realized that if he were furloughed one day a pay period, the amount of take-home he would be getting from work would be less than the take-home he would get if he retired from his pension, his TSP, and so on. So I think he made the decision, hey, it's time to get out of here. But we don't want to jump unprepared financially or emotionally into retirement. We need to give the future some thought.
Well, Tom Timmon made a good point this morning on the Federal Drive. He said, and Tom has been in this business watching government for years, and he said he's seen a number of federal workers, high-ranking, who retired, and they went to a place that only wanted them for a short spell period of time, you know, while they were still fresh, still had their context, while their Rolodex was updated, but that often they didn't last more than a year. So I guess that's a different version of what you're saying is, rather than retiring from something, retire to something that you know is going to be good, you're going to like, and it will last as long as you want it to.
Yes, and indeed, in my book, which you referenced earlier in the conversation, Career Transition, A Guide for Federal Employees, we do have a couple chapters. Chapter 2, Should You Stay with the Federal Government? It goes through reasons to stay, reasons to leave. Chapter 3, What Will You Do? Then we also talk about retirement, the private sector job market, if people are looking for work out there, and so on. So leaving is both financial and emotional when it comes to that. And I guess I should warn folks that the private sector is certainly no more stable than the federal sector, perhaps less with the federal government, even though things are insecure. We know that if we come into work tomorrow morning, we're not going to be called into our manager's office, given a cardboard box, and told that we and 25 of our closest friends are being laid off. We have 2 hours to pack up our belongings and get out of the building.
You know, I have physically seen that happen 3 different times with 2 different companies where they came in and announced that everybody on the 3rd floor was fired, and when you'd go out for lunch, your ex-colleagues would be standing there with cardboard boxes waiting for their spouses to make a surprise pickup early.
Yeah, I think it's almost like one of those, I felt bad because I had no shoes, then mm-hmm. I met a man who had no feet.
Well, it's interesting you would talk about that the perils of the private sector, and also what are you going to do with yourself? Because I have a friend, he's younger than I am, and he's been retired for 7 or 8 years now, and he kept saying his goal in life was to never again enter another office. And after some time in retirement, he now says, I see why you could keep working. I see why you like to go into the office. And he's talking about the interplay with people and the exchanges you make. So retirement is not a panacea. That said, if I'm a federal worker in Washington area, it looks to me like I am a pretty good commodity for a lot of companies. You have education, you have skills, you have contacts, but also the financials you bring to the table are, I have my own health insurance. You may or may not have a company plan. It's certainly not going to be better than the federal program, so I will keep it. So that's one less expense for the company. I have an annuity, a pension for life that's indexed to inflation, so I can maybe come in and take a job at a salary that's lower than I would have if it had been the one I had to depend on. And finally, the security clearance. If you've got top secret or cosmic or whatever they call it, that's worth its weight in gold, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. That's one of the big things. Anyone with secret and above has a definite leg up over those of us like myself who simply had what they called sensitive level clearances.
John, what about your career in government, your time in government?
Well, I spent my first 9 years as a mailman.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, that's when I first heard about the high five. It was close to 40 years ago. Someone said, oh, they're going to change the way our pensions are computed to a high five. Hasn't happened yet. Then I ended up working for one of the Treasury bureaus in the Chicago area. And after I had a total of 26 years federal service, there was a major reorganization. My job and all its responsibilities went down to Austin, Texas. And I thought, gee, I kind of like it here in Chicago, although I'm beginning to question my sanity in the winter. And I ended up working for myself. I said, I can do all the things I like working for myself. And it just so happens that I really do love what I do. I don't feel like I'm working. I feel like it's a hobby, something I enjoy to do that happens to pay me money while I'm doing it. So there are lots of different options for people who were feds. Their expertise can transfer a lot of different places.
Have you been tracking this? It's now the law, but it hasn't been implemented yet because they're still writing the guidelines. But this transitioned retirement that the government is looking at?
Yes, the so-called phased retirement.
Yeah, John, excuse me, we're getting the signal to take a break here. Hold that thought. We'll be right back here on Federal News Radio. Back to your turn. I'm Mike Causey. We're talking with John Grobe. He's president of Federal Career Experts, and he wrote a book called Career Transition, A Guide to Federal Employees. And we asked John to join us today because of the uncertainty of federal employment. While it's still probably much safer than it is on the outside, a lot of people are tired of being beat up by the press, by politicians. They're tired of pay freezes and talks of extended freezes. And now where the sequestration threat is looming, and that one is going to be followed by the continuing resolution threat. So this seems to be threat month for federal workers, and a good time to do threat assessment. John, I was asking you before the break about this the new government program that will permit people to transition into retirement. How's that going to work?
Well, hopefully it will work. OPM says they're going to implement it in the spring, so that's about a month from now. Should be the first day of spring, so we can be expecting it sometime between now and the end of June, assuming OPM gets it on time. The way it works is an individual would not completely retire. They would retire part-time. This is a little bit different from something OPM had introduced back in 2009, where people who were already retired could come back to work on a part-time basis. Let's just do an example. Let's say that I am going to work at my job for 3 days and be retired for 2 days. Now, to participate in phased retirement, I have to commit a certain percentage of my time to mentoring new employees. The whole concept of phased retirement was sold to Congress as a human capital management tool as opposed to a way to be nice to federal employees. I think ways to be nice to federal employees generally don't get very far in Congress these days. But back to the example, I would receive 60% of the salary for the job. I'm working 3 days, and I would receive 20% of the pension I have earned because I'm retired for 2 days. At the end of this period, they would recompute my pension based on the extra time that I'd worked in phased retirement. For example, if I were in phased retirement, let's just say for 1 year, I would get not one full additional year's credit for that time, but it would be better than absolutely no credit for the time. They would prorate the additional computation of my pension. And just in case there's anyone out there who's a special category employee, a law enforcement officer, a firefighter, or so on, who thinks this might be a good idea, well, you can't participate in it. Anyone who has mandatory retirement is not going to be allowed to participate in phased retirement. So I guess we have to wait for the OPM regulations that are going to deal with the nuts and bolts.
Yeah, one of the problems with writing is it's easy for Congress to say set up a program that emphasizes mentoring and make it work. But the devil is always in the details, particularly with federal regulations. And one of the things OPM has to do is figure out how you can continue to work, as you said, maybe for a year, working 3 days a week, and it not have any impact on your high three salary average. And that's what the law says to do, but now they have to figure out how to make it work. So we'll find out this spring, hopefully. John, back to people getting ready to retire. You said retire to something rather than retire from something. So you need to make sure your parachute landing zone is a good one.
You absolutely do. It's a good thing to think ahead. Retirement is a major transition in our life. If we think of earlier transitions from the world of school to the world of work, that was a pretty hefty transition. We've been in the world of work now for oh, what, 30-plus years, we're thinking of retirement. That's a major transition. All of a sudden, I'm not commuting into the office. I have at least 45, maybe 55 extra hours a week to fill up. They don't cut the number of hours in the week. And if I'm in a relationship, that's an extra period of face time that I have to spend with my spouse or significant other. So if you're in a relationship, retiring can be considered a team sport as well.
I knew a financial planner, and he said when he'd counsel couples about retirement, he would turn to the wife and say, you're going to have half the income and twice the husband. And it's a pretty sobering thought in some cases.
Yes, and some old colleagues of mine used the phrase when someone retires. They said, I married you for better or for worse. Not for lunch.
Exactly. I've heard that. Yeah. Yeah. John, and the same goes, too, for men. The person I was talking to had some issues with being with a spouse 24/7.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't actually retire from work because I still work for myself, but I retired from the routine and worked at home. And my wife did not take early retirement. She worked longer. So when she retired, it was like I had an intruder in my routine. We had a little bit of adjusting to do to that. It's something that it pays to think about. And there's an author named Richard Bowles, whose last name is spelled B-O-L-L-E-S, and a lot of people know him because he wrote a job search book called What Color Is Your Parachute? He actually wrote a book for retirement called What Color Is Your Parachute for Retirement? The concept of the book being that we don't necessarily know what we're facing in retirement, so just like he did in his job search book, he walks you through assessments. Some are paper and pencil, but most of them are online, you know, exploring your interests, exploring your personality, exploring your values, and what type of retirement activities might you be likely to enjoy, what kind might you want to stay away from. It's a great book for the soft side of retirement.
I did not read it, but I remember it very well. It was definitely a bestseller. It was sort of the Mars-Venus book of its day. Back to something you said earlier. You were talking about a friend, I think you said he was with Treasury, but that he had looked at what would happen if he was furloughed one day a week, and he looked at his, I guess you're talking about his deductions, that higher taxes, retirement contributions, thrift savings plan deductions, and that sort of thing. And he concluded that he would take home more money in retirement than he would working in a furlough situation. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. Now, he does have an advantage that a lot of federal employees don't have. The advantage is spelled with four letters, and those letters are CSRS.
Yes.
He was going to have somewhere north of 30 years, and he'd been maxing the TSP since its inception. But, yeah, he had the CSRS advantage.
Yeah, the CSRS, for the people who maybe only just arrived from the moon, it was the old civil service retirement system, and it was replaced in the mid-1980s by FERS, the Federal Employees Retirement System. And FERS has some advantages. Among the others, it's portable and it has a Social Security component. But the civil service portion of the FERS annuity is about half, again, what people under the CSRS system get. So, and most of the people that are retiring now, I assume, are still under the old civil service retirement system. They're fading fast, but most people who are retirement eligible are under the CSRS system.
If I were to go by the composition of the pre-retirement classes that I do for my firm, I would have to say that there are more FERS people retiring now.
Really? Okay. Well, they certainly outnumber the CSRS.
There's a higher percentage of CSRS people eligible to retire. I think more than 60% of CSRS employees are already eligible to retire, while that corresponding percentage for FERS is only about 10%. but there's so many more FERS employees out there.
Yeah, good. John, listen, thank you for joining us. We're going to have to move along here. We'll be talking with Julia Ziegler from the Federal News Radio staff. She's going to be talking about our very popular poll on sequestration. We'll be right back after this break. Mike Causey here, back to your turn, and my guest is our web manager.
Yeah, that's
web manager, Julia Ziegler, and the pride of Penn State.
That's
and
right.
And you're here today to actually talk about a couple of things, and one of them is the sequestration poll, and I use the royal we, that we at Federal News Radio have put out, and I see it's leading our list of most read or most visited sites. What's it all about?
Yeah, it is. So we've had actually over 12,000 responses, 12,000 people who have actually taken this poll, which I would say is one of the best polls we've ever done. It's the best response rate we've ever had. We started the poll about 2 weeks ago, and at that time, the question was, sequestration is less than 2 weeks away. Will it happen? Of course, now, you know, sequestration is just a day away.
Yeah.
And here are the results over the past few weeks. 56% of people answered the poll by saying, yes, we are up the creek without a paddle. So will it happen? Yes, we are up the creek without a paddle, 56%. 40% saying Congress will delay implementation again, and only 4% saying no, sequestration will not happen. Why are people being so alarmist? So if you add all those up, that means 96% of the people taking our poll believe nothing is happening one way or another, whether it's because they're just not going to, you know, inevitably never going to do something about sequestration, or because they're going to kick it down the road a little bit.
Well, and those numbers changed because I looked at them Friday, mm-hmm. and it was 54%, I think, said that it was going to happen.
Exactly, yeah. So it's gone up a little bit in the terms of the number of people who think that sequestration will in fact happen and no one's going to do anything to stop it. What we did was I actually just reset the poll. So it's going to be interesting to see how these numbers change in the next 2 days. So we now know the numbers from the past 2 weeks, but now as we are just 2 days away, you know, tomorrow being the last day of the month, whether or not, you know, we'll see how people think, what people think now, you know, how will these numbers change will be very interesting to kind of view over the next 2 days.
Yeah. Well, speaking of kicking the can down the road, I got a neat email this morning from a loyal and faithful reader, listener, uh-huh. Harvey G. Oh. And he had a question for you or for us. He said there was one we missed.
Yeah. This was actually very interesting. And I think Harvey G might be right. And what he said to us was, your sequester poll is missing a choice. And the choice that he thinks we should have added was, we need to cut, let the sequester happen. And he says, I'm a government worker and I'm willing to sacrifice to start eroding the tax and spend culture. I want a fair flat tax, entitlement reform, and managed cuts like cutting out all of the Department of Energy, Education, and Commerce. And he says, any true responsibilities from those agencies could be transferred to others.
Very interesting. You know, I've been reading the comments to my column, the Federal Report, and they've been an unusual number this time of year because of sequestration mm-hmm. and the issues involved. And they're less political than they often are, but there's some very smart people out there. I mean, I'm so impressed with some of their arguments about this. But it's surprising how many of them, certainly not a majority, but how many said, yeah, I'm willing to make mm-hmm. these cuts if they get serious, if they really do it. You know, and some of them think that they're needed.
Yeah. You know, one of the other interesting things that people have been saying when it does come to the political side of this, and you and I have talked about this, is the Bob Woodward article or column that came out recently. And, you know, who actually started sequestration? And we are seeing a lot of that in the comments on federalnewsradio.com as well. And, you know, Bob Woodward's piece saying that, you know, sequestration was a White House idea that that Jack Lew and Rob Neighbors in the White House passed on to Harry Reid in the Senate. And then, you know, inevitably the Congress did pass it, but that this whole idea of sequestration did start with the White House. So what we see in the comments is a lot of back and forth about, was this a, you know, is this the Republicans' fault? Is this, you know, the White House's fault? And where did it actually come from?
That's very important, because in the shutdown of 95-96, that was a who blinks first contest between Newt Gingrich, Speaker of the House, and President Bill Clinton. And the shutdown happened, and the Republicans lost the public relations war, and Gingrich was out shortly thereafter. It's interesting that this comes from Bob Watergate Woodward, because he says in here that Obama personally approved of the plan for Lew and Neighbors to propose a successor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. They did so at 2:30 p.m. on July 27th, 2011.
Yeah, so pretty exact,
that, that is Bob Woodward, vintage Bob Woodward. But yeah, so it's the White House set it up, and they were saying it was a poison pill. Never thought it would come to this. And then the president, on at least two occasions that I've heard, has said it's not going to happen. So very interesting back and forth politics here.
Yeah. The other thing that I did want to bring up, you know, something interesting that we didn't actually plan it this way, but it happened to work out really well. On federalnewsradio.com right now, we have a new special report that we just released this morning called Top Leaders in Federal Service. And it's interesting because we're talking about leadership at a time when leadership in the federal government is perhaps as important as it's ever been, you know, with sequestration and CRs and morale issues in the federal workforce. What we're doing on federalnewsradio.com is taking a look at some of the people in federal government who have been real leaders throughout these past few years and you know, for, you know, majority of their careers, and what it is that they do that their employees really appreciate, and what it is that they do that maybe other leaders in the federal government could emulate. So I urge people to take a look at that. And tomorrow we'll be actually releasing the results of a survey we did talking about morale and how federal employee morale is directly tied to leadership or a lack thereof in the federal government.
Very good. Thank you, Julia Zeger. We'll get you back on this. And it was a very good poll. Now we're going to move on over and talk to Steve Losey, from a senior writer with the Federal Times. Steve, I know you got a lot on your notebook there.
Yeah, it's been pretty crazy. And also, we've got Sean Riley here.
Sean, Sean, good. Good to have you.
We got a team here.
Yes. Well, one thing I wanted to get to, that was all this talk about sequestration. Some people can't get enough, particularly in the news media. Many federal workers have had more than enough. But isn't a worse crisis than sequestration looming with the continuing resolution?
Yeah, that could be the other bomb that's waiting to go off. The continuing resolution that is now in effect expires at the end of March, and the government's going to either have to pass another CR temporarily funding the government at roughly current levels, or pass an actual budget, which they've been so good at the last couple of years. So, yeah, and if they don't come to an agreement, the government could shut down. So that's – we could, you know – potentially, if they come to some agreement on sequestration, we could be out of the frying pan and into the fire if the government can't reach another funding agreement.
And is that magic date March 27th?
That's right.
Okay, so it's an odd time. Not the 31st, not the 1st, but March 27th.
Yeah, I think that's just how the count of the days just ended up once they passed this original six-month CR.
Right. And the sequestration, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's going to start slow. Because on the furlough front, a lot of agencies have said they're going to furlough people. The White House is still firming up the numbers. But they must give them 30 days written notice. And some people are saying those won't go out until mid-March. So it could be mid-April at the earliest before the first person is furloughed. Isn't that right?
That's right. You know, I went to a press conference at the Pentagon last week, and they are the ones who've been the most open about their furlough plans of all the federal agencies. And I think it's probably their plans are probably more or less what other agencies that are going to have to furlough employees, not all agencies, of course, but agencies that do have to furlough employees might follow the Pentagon's plan more or less. The comptroller, Robert Hale, he said the Pentagon is going to tell employees in mid-March that they're likely to be furloughed, and that gives them 30 days advance notice before they're furloughed, so they'll get their actual notice in mid-April. And they're predicting furloughs would begin about late April. So we're roughly maybe not quite 2 months away from actual furlough dates.
Well, last week we were talking about the legal complexities of this, and an attorney pointed out that federal workers, within the 30 days between the time they get a furlough notice and they go on furlough, they can file an appeal with the MSPB, the Merit Systems Protection Board, and in some cases the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, but they could file a complaint. Would doing that stop the furlough?
No, and actually, it's my understanding that the 30-day clock to file an appeal begins the day that they get that actual notice that they are going to be furloughed. Not that you might be furloughed, but that you actually are going to be furloughed, which would be mid-April. So what we could potentially be seeing is people who are furloughed in the midst of their furlough filing appeals to MSPB. Now, if they go to MSPB and MSPB were for some reason to say, yes, you were improperly furloughed, then they would get back pay for the days that they were furloughed. However, it's really anybody's guess as to whether any such furlough appeals would be successful because they are so massive. They are so widespread. It's not likely that, I don't think it's going to be likely that people are going to say, I was furloughed because I was young or old or because of my gender or because of my race, because everybody is getting furloughed in many agencies.
Yeah, that's what this attorney was saying. He called it a disparate impact. But you need to take a short break here, talking with Sean Riley and Steve Losey from the Federal Times. Be right back here on Federal News Radio. Mike Closey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Steve Losey and Sean Riley from the Federal Times about sequestration and all manner of things. Washington Post raised an interesting point this morning. They were talking with the chairwoman of the Merit Systems Protection Board, and we had her later on the radio, too. But she was telling the Post that they would have to furlough people, and so who would process these claims, and that they might have to contract it out.
Yeah, they are really kind of between a rock and a hard place. They're looking at – they really have I spoke to the chairwoman the other day as well, and she told me that they have really no idea what kind of a appeal crush they're going to see because of these furloughs. It could potentially double their workload while they're trying to comply with these cuts on their own. So, she used the phrase perfect storm to describe it. It just sounds like just a giant mess in the works at MSPB.
Have you actually seen the White House directions on this? The Transparency Act. It's 394 pages.
I have not. No.
Okay.
Report they put out last August?
Right, yeah. I wanted to print the first page just as a visual, but by mistake I printed out the entire thing, and everybody here is mad at me now because it took up our budget for merit raises for the year. But it's like the biggest big city telephone book you ever saw back in the day when everybody had telephones and numbers listed. Sean, what are you working on?
I think we're just working on one thing, more or less, sequestration. And I was going to add to what Steve was saying. I mean, there's still a lot of uncertainty out there, I think. I was at a town hall meeting up at the Social Security Administration's headquarters in the Baltimore area on Monday where Senator Ben Cardin spoke. And the employees I talked to, I think for a lot of them, the possibility of furloughs, which Social Security says, the management says they're going to minimize the risk of that as much as possible. But it's really just beginning to sink in that, furloughs are a possibility, that this is actually going to happen. There's not going to be a last-minute deal to head it off. And there's still, I think, a lot of uncertainty among agency management about how to handle this. I just got a copy of a memo that went out, I think, yesterday from the acting administrator of EPA, Bob Perciasepe, who's saying that they're looking at up to 13 furlough days, but they are going to try and minimize the impact, and they're going to essentially do this in phases, and they'll do one phase, I think, that'll run for a couple months, and they'll look at that and decide whether additional furloughs are needed. But at this point, they're at least tentatively planning to essentially shut down the agency, more or less, except for emergency personnel, for 3 days. in May, July, and August.
Pull the Band-Aid off quickly.
Or September, rather.
Yeah. Well, you know, the implication has been that the air traffic control is going to be slowed down, not only because of the TSA, but also because of air traffic controllers, if they would furlough them. But it would seem to me there's another way to do this, and that is to obviously not furlough everybody on the same day, and not furlough, not shut down your tower in Leesburg or your main centers in Atlantic City and Oklahoma City, but do it, you know, a drop at a time, an individual at a time.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I doubt many places are going to say, okay, Friday is a furlough day, nobody come in that day. They're going to try to stagger these out as much as possible. But even doing that, it's kind of there's bound to be some slowdown, even if you've just taken just a chunk out of the workforce for each day to try to maintain operations. The people who are remaining are not going to be able to do the same amount of work as a fully staffed office.
Well, I saw a column in the Post last week, and the person was saying, and I assume the numbers are right, that the FAA has more people, more controllers now than it did a few years back when air traffic was heavier.
I don't know. I haven't seen those numbers, but I'll have to take the Post word for it.
Yeah. But, I mean, it looks like there's a way to work around this. Do you think there's a little politics going on here and that some of these are scare stories about we're going to have to furlough the FBI and furlough the DEA, and Customs and Border Patrol is talking about furloughs? The implication, again, is that the country is wide open. Come on in.
Well, there's always politics going on. Anytime someone sneezes, there's a political motive behind it. However, that doesn't necessarily mean that some of these warnings that are being handed out are false. I mean, the Justice Department is facing, I believe, $1.6 billion in budget reductions, and that money's got to come from somewhere. And furloughs are one of the avenues that federal managers, agency leaders at many agencies have opted to select. So, I mean, these people, you know, despite, you know, the stereotype from some corners of, you know, federal employees just sitting around twiddling their thumbs, these workers actually do work, at least the vast majority of them. So you are not going to be able to furlough them and just kind of slough it off. There's going to be an effect. And I think it's that realization is just starting to sink in to our readership and your listenership. We put a blog up late last week asking for comments with people's thoughts. It's gotten, you know, dozens of responses. I've spoken to several of those people. You can't underestimate the exasperation that is out there in the federal workforce. They are not hearing anything from their leadership, anything useful at least, beyond maybe there will be furloughs. And they are scared and they are irritated and they are just dismayed at the lack of leadership coming from Washington, D.C., and it is killing the morale and it is killing the productivity of the federal workforce. So even before furloughs have taken effect, the effectiveness of the government is taking a serious blow.
Well, looking at the thickness of this White House guide to open government, but this is the act that set up the sequestration, and looking at the details and the number of pages, 394, and that goes to all federal agencies, and then they in turn had to come up with their plan and send it back to the OMB for approval. So how much time has been spent preparing for the sequestration, which may never happen?
Hours, dozens, hundreds of hours. I couldn't tell you. I was a couple of weeks ago, in Maryland at a NIH town hall where the leader of the NIH, he couldn't put a figure on it, but he said that, you know, his top managers are spending, you know, night after night trying to figure out how to work this whole thing out when they could be doing things like, you know, researching cures for cancer or disease. Same with the Pentagon. The comptroller said that he and his folks have been working late nights trying to figure out how this entirely avoidable calamity is going to take effect. So, yeah, there's just an insane amount of time being wasted on something that could very easily be avoided.
I don't know what's happening today, but are you surprised that so far Wall Street's reaction seems to be ho-hum?
I am kind of surprised. I kind of expected things to take a serious dive a lot earlier as it becomes more and more apparent that that Washington is completely incapable of functioning. Maybe there, you know, there's still some optimists on Wall Street, and they're waiting to see what happens Friday. And so who knows? Maybe Monday morning things could take a serious dive.
Real quick, again, or we don't have time. Lauren's going to give me the hook here in a minute. But I thank you guys for being with us. And I guess next week we'll be talking about the they pulled the rabbit out of the hat and sequestration was avoided, or we'll be in the middle of it. So thank you. See you all here next week. Remember, the shows are archived on our homepage, so you can listen anytime.